Thank you very much. And I'm sorry that Dr. Waite couldn't join us here, because for 30 years, Dr. Waite was the director of all the clinical services for the Commonwealth of Virginia's and all their incarcerated population, which runs about 1,000 to 1,500 kids a year. So did I just click this one? Okay, briefly what we'd like to do today is to give you just the scope of the issues, look at some prevalence data of the kids that are in the system. I would be talking more about juvenile correctional treatment delivery issues, but that's really Dennis's ball game, and as an outside researcher, I know it from a researcher's perspective. And also look at some issues on public health and how criminal justice and incarceration in Virginia might be related to that. Generally, as most of you may know, 20% of children and adolescents in the general population at any one time can be diagnosed with a mental health disorder. 10% of those disorders have been severe enough to impair functioning in the home. And more recent data, and looking at some meta-analysis, these statistics can range from as little as 3% in some studies to 40%, even in the general population. But there's not enough real good data in these areas at this point to look at adolescents. In the juvenile justice system across the U.S., it's been reported that the mental health rates are 2 to 4 times that of the general population, with 60 and 70% of the incarcerated kids having a disorder. So this is 1 out of 5 youth with serious disorders. We found that Virginia is fairly similar right there at this point. 1 out of 10 of the kids that come into the center need immediate attention of some sort. 60% of males and 90% of females that are committed to the state juvenile justice system leave the reception and diagnostic center with a designated mental health need. In Virginia, we have what's called the Youth Profile Database, and I'll briefly explain kind of what that is. When any kid comes into the system, for the first 3 or 4 weeks, they get an extensive diagnosis based on their medical history. They see a physician, they see nurses, they get all the psychosocial evaluations, a clinical evaluation, and then they get staffed. Also, all the medical records and educational records are forwarded to the reception and diagnostic center. So there's incredibly good documented data on everybody that comes into the system. From that data, they compiled about 6,600 variables on each kid. And what we have here is data on about 6,000 kids over 5 and 6 years of time, which is between 95 and 99% of the admissions. The clinicians are licensed who do the mental health assessments, and this is good. So who are the kids in Virginia? On average, 90% are males and 10% are females, and this hasn't changed in the last 15 years that I've been working in the system. The average age is 16, and it ranges from 11 to 20. That's gone up a bit. It used to be lower, around 15. And the race and ethnic groups are primarily the same. It's mostly African American and white, and in recent years, we've been adding 135 Hispanic kids and a few Native Americans and so-called others, which are 35 Asians and people who have mixed race. They need to basically look at different ways to categorize people to capture, I think, the cultural and ethnic differences. Excuse me. So when the kids arrive there, and I have a habit, they're kids to me, and it's really hard for me to switch that after all these years, but 2/3 of the youth have had 2 or more living situations prior to incarceration. 20 of these kids, when they get here, have reported running away from home, and 10% of them have been homeless for as long as 3 months. At the time they arrive, their living situation has been that 39% live with their mothers, only 5% with their fathers, and 13% with both natural parents. The incarcerated fathers of sex offenders in 2003, and between 98 and 2003, it was about 22% of incarcerated boys and girls had fathers who were in prison or had a jail history, and 8% had mothers who were also incarcerated. The most recent data, I think the numbers were as much as 40% different subgroups. So over from 99 to 93, we have questions on any kind of sexual abuse or sexual assault. This includes sexual assault by or abuse by a parent, some trusted friends, or someone else. And you can see that for women in the system, which is 10% of the sample, it was a high of 44% in 99 into some bad assessments in 2003, in my opinion, because there's a huge drop and not much change during that time except some structural changes inside the department. And for males, it stayed between 10 and 7% across those times. So many of the youth who are incarcerated are also parents. 20% of the boys and about 17-18% of the girls, they have children of their own, so which complicates the matter in terms of their criminal lifestyle and what can be done to help them when they get out and their extended families. And also they smoke, not surprisingly, and they smoke marijuana. 65% and 62% of females are smokers. And one slide I had, I actually got data from the University of Virginia, and I compared it alongside of the smoking and drug use of the kids in the population, and it was very similar for alcohol and marijuana, and the big differences came in the opioids and cocaine and some of the hard drugs. But the just seeing those differences of a college population where 90% are married and high functioning and wealthy with kids who are really disadvantaged, that many of these baseline indicators and substance use were surprisingly the same, but the outcomes have been quite different. So within this system, I think we have a big conflict in providing any kind of treatment and help that tends to work, especially in my experience coming from the outside and being in the system. There's the punishment side of corrections, with those of you who are in the system know, and then there's the treatment perspective. And along with that goes security and the conflicts of how to deal with treatment in a system where you may have aggressive acting out people, where everybody loves the security people when they need them, but if the clinicians want to get them in a certain kind of environment that conflicts with the rules of the organization, it's sort of an ongoing set of issues. So security's role, which is a very important role, because these kids, by the time they get there, are highly aggressive. 10% are sex offenders, lots of assault and battery, robbery, but they're major offenses. For security, they have an administrative role, and they need to control order here and now. They're dealing with what's going on in the present, maintaining an environment where people can live for months and sometimes years and not be harmed and move forward in their education, hopefully their treatment. But I found that the security staff and administrators tend to be somewhat dismissive of treatment as being secondary to their role. With the treatment's role and the clinicians, they're kind of focusing more on the individual rather than the system, and they're advocating for the youth. And this is specifically the clinicians who are social workers and psychologists and the nursing staff who deal with kids one-on-one and get to know them. And their goal is to prepare them for release. So I think some of those issues, I don't know if they're ever going to be resolved, but it's been some barriers to treatment in the past. So here's a snapshot of who's in the system, what they look like, just to give you an idea. So for any prior psychiatric hospitalization, and this is documented, so it's not self-reported information, it's about 36% of white females, 30% of black females, 25% of white males, 11% of black males, and 11% of Hispanics have had a prior psychiatric hospitalization, typically from between 1 and 5 days. The suicide attempts also are not that uncommon, and as you would expect, they're higher for the females than males, but they're high. Any psychotropic medication use, these are documented cases, and you can see that from 93 to 2003, there's been a steady increase in the number of kids who come in and are evaluated already on psychotropic medication use. So a history, when you look at it by race and ethnic groups, the lowest users of medication are black males and Hispanic males, And whites all across the board are more highly medicated. Substance use DSM diagnosis, you find the same kinds of relationship in that for substance use disorder. So if you combine some substance abuse and less, Dennis put that in there because that was less of a problem, with oppositional defiant disorder, conduct disorder, ADHD, and mental retardation, that's kind of, you get the same picture. So across the board, these co-occurring disorders keep going over and over. For those who need a designated mental health treatment need, once they're evaluated over a 3-week period and they try to triage them into the existing services, what you find is, you know, 87% to 53% need treatment. So whose responsibility is it? When you're in the Department of Criminal Justice Services or the Department of Juvenile Justice, you have one person who is taking a lead. If you're in the community, it's someone else. So the mental health departments, community service boards, and others, if the kid's in the community, that's where they go. But if you're incarcerated, detention or juvenile correctional facilities, it's the Juvenile Justice Department. And it can change depending on who's running the organization, on which way the treatment and what the belief systems are. So the juvenile justice system can, and they should, be an effective treatment environment for very aggressive adolescents with severe mental problems if staffed with competent clinicians supported by institutional practices. That treatment services will be effective only if they're incorporated into the facility operations and supported by institutional practices. And this goes back to Dr. Waite's points that if there's a conflict between safety and security and rehabilitation and safety, it's very hard to move things forward. We did an informal survey of judges, and we had them rank what the purpose of incarceration for adolescents was on a scale and determine the sentence. Was it punishment or was it rehab? And it was really interesting because the results were very split on what the purpose was. And about half said it was to rehabilitate the youth so that they could have a life, and the other said it was to punish them. And it was the same kind of conflict when you look at an indeterminate sentence where the youth is committed until they improve versus serving their time and paying their debt to society. So in the public health perspective, and this is where I'm coming in, is that I'm also involved in a study in mental health having to do with kids in Virginia who are evaluated for services due to a mental health crisis. And at that point, they are evaluated and they may get treatment when they're in school or they may not. And it seems like we need to do a better job of identifying what's going on and doing something before it's too late. So prevention and intervention programs are needed to address the problems before the youth end up into the system. And currently, we have very few community-based treatment options for youth who need mental health, and thus the prisons become the new mental health facilities, at least in Virginia. And I hope this doesn't show up in the paper in Richmond. So. But basically, I mean, that is one of the findings, that over the years from 1990, when we first started out, the number of kids with mental health problems has soared, and the beds available for kids in the community have gone the other direction. So, thank you.